better support and American leadership, we have better ask Afghans. They have the experience of 20 years of Western forces presence in their country. Afghans had counted on Western powers at the beginning, but what the US and its allies really brought for Afghanistan?
Betrayal, definitely. The US and its allies' presence led our country to gallop backward. However, they failed in Afghanistan and ruined our country. We didn't gain anything from dealing with the West except destruction, poverty, and many, many crises.
Sayed Bakir Kazemi was an advisor to the former Afghan president Ashraf Ghani. He believes Ghani's government easily collapsed because he trusted the US and relied on NATO forces.
It is obvious and historically proven that any government or administration that trusted the U.S. or relied on the West ended up with failure and downfall. This experience is repeated in many countries. Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani did the same mistake and faced a bad downfall.
Some Afghan experts also blame crisis in Ukraine on the U.S., saying nations are falling victim to the U.S. policies of creating war and terror.
The U.S. is using Ukrainians for its own benefits. Western powers don't care about the collapse and destruction of a nation or government. They follow their own devil policies. Afghanistan's experience is repeating in Ukraine. I hope Ukrainians' leaders learn from Afghanistan disaster and crisis ends in their country.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year. Today, the country is dealing with the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Afghans are critical of U.S. policies and its legacy on their soil. They consider trusting the U.S. as a big mistake that no country should ever make it. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight.
Iran is among the very few countries which have succeeded in sending satellites into orbit around the Earth without any assistance from any outsiders and in the face of a wide variety of sanctions, or more properly, economic terrorism by its enemy, the U.S. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kayhan, International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Iran's Spectacular Success in Outer Space. Stay tuned for more. Thanks to the Islamic Revolution and the self-confidence it has instilled in the Iranians, there is no field they have not mastered, including the nuclear fuel cycle, modern medicine, cyberspace, artificial intelligence, and exploring outer space. As a matter of fact, Iran is among the very few countries which have succeeded in sending satellites into orbit around the Earth without any assistance from any outsiders, and in the face of a wide variety of sanctions, or more properly, economic terrorism, by its enemy, the U.S. This has further exasperated Washington, where the politicians and their Zionist overlords are clearly confused. One group thinks that the U.S. failed in clamping more sanctions on the Iranian people to reduce them to misery and poverty that would have deprived them of the incentive and resolve to achieve self-reliance and self-sufficiency, which ensure the Islamic Republic's progress and independence. Another group is of the opinion that the United States, which despite being a superpower, sorely lacks the means to subjugate an awakened Islamic nation like Iran has succeeded in slowing down the pace of progress of the indomitable Iranian people, who would have outpaced the Western scientists in science and technology, and by now would have driven out the CENTCOM terrorists from the neighborhood, if not for the sanctions of the past four decades. Whatever Washington and its comrades in crime against humanity think, we in Iran are the least concerned and will never for a moment drop our guard against our enemy, while continuing with our path towards the pinnacles of progress. The latest achievement in science and technology was made on Tuesday, March 8, when the Aerospace Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, launched its second homegrown satellite into a low Earth orbit, LEO, less than 2 years after the launch of its first satellite. The Nur 2, or Light 2, brilliantly flew into outer space on a three-stage satellite carrier named Asid, literally meaning messenger, at the velocity of 7.6 kilometers per second, and was placed into orbit 500 kilometers above the Earth's surface in a mere 480 seconds after the blast off. It is already sending signals to the ground stations in Iran and the IRGC, which is admired by the independent countries and popular movements of the region and the world, has promised new surprises, much to the chagrin of the Americans and their accomplices in the West. Nur 2 satellite is to carry out a range of military and civilian missions in Iran, including reconnaissance and natural disaster response operations. It should be recalled that on April 22, 2020, the IRGC had successfully placed Nur 1 into orbit 425 kilometers above the Earth's surface, and the satellite was circling our planet once every 90 minutes. Now Nur 2 will greatly augment the mission of its predecessor and improve vital transmissions to Iran. There is no looking back for Iran, which is fully confident of more spectacular achievements that will soon dwarf the Americans and the Europeans and break their monopoly on science and technology.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. When Prophet Ibrahim informed his son Ismail about the order of Allah, the young Ismail, without any complaint, stated, "O father, do whatever Allah has ordered you." This is how the faithful people of Allah act. They listen carefully to Allah and apply His orders in their lives. This sentence of Prophet Ismail shows his great soul. Although young, he acted as a mature believer who accepts all the divine duties and orders. This is what we call dutifulness.
وقتی هم اومد گفت بابا دست و پا منو ببند یه وقت نخوام فرار کنم.
The faithfulness of Prophet Ismail to the order of Allah was to an extent that he made some suggestions to his father, Prophet Ibrahim. He told his father to rope him so that he cannot escape. Also, he told his father not to go home soon when you performed Allah's duty. Also, do not take anything from me like a cloth to remember me and forget Allah's order. Ismail also asked his father to fold his eyes when doing Allah's order. These are all mentioned in the Tafsir of Quran by Abul Futuh Razi. Truly, Prophet Ismail and Prophet Ibrahim are the best examples of those who fulfill Allah's order. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
sanctions followed by dissatisfaction, dissent, demonstration, and ongoing tension. That would be the normal sequence of events. But in Iran, tension hasn't been ongoing on a large scale, greatly because the country has managed to provide essential and secondary goods in spite of the U.S.'s harshest ever sanctions for the past few years. The government has assigned $1 billion a month to providing essential goods and provisions in spite of limitations on providing foreign currency.
4 or 5 years of the harshest ever U.S. sanctions, evolving from 40 years of U.N.-backed sanctions, and Iran is still standing. Ironically, that's partly because of 4 decades of exposure. Iran has learned to survive by finding ways round sanctions, apart from the fact that it has a complex, multifaceted economy and vast social capital. For more, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Unemployment is high, inflation is high, and we may be running out of foreign exchange. But shop shelves are stacked to abundance in the capital and big cities, and provisions fit the population as they did elsewhere. Stuff ain't cheap, but it's there. How did it get there, and will it stay there? Our show guest explains how sustainable the situation is in the shadow of sanctions. Mr. Ali Eshaq is head of the Commerce Center of Tehran. He was Minister of Commerce in the Khatami government. He draws on measures taken in his days in politics as guidelines for today.
The country's trade is the result of the cooperation and collaboration of several different units. If trade is to be boosted so the goods can reach the end customer at an affordable price and conveniently, the central bank, the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ministry of Agriculture, Ministry of Economy and others must all work together towards the same common goal. Their job is like a car whose all 4 wheels must move at the same time and in the same direction. If the wheels aren't aligned, the more you accelerate, the greater risk of breaking down you're putting the car at. This means that trade, currency, monetary, tax, transportation, and all other policies have to be adopted considering a common goal. No matter where they're moving towards, they all need to aim at the same goal.
Economic sanctions target sanctioned countries' foreign trade and government behavior before anything, meaning they root to change targeted governments' behavior and get them to submit. Sanctions are typically meant to influence both the cost-benefit analysis of national decision-makers and their ability to implement problematic policies. And American economic controls, especially on military material, will have imposed functional constraints on Iran's defense capabilities and regional influence, should it want that. But as economic U.S. sanctions generally fail its foreign policy goals, so have its restrictions on military equipment and programs. Mr. Merhaba, MP, shared his views with us as the House closed. We made a trek down to Parliament to hear him as member of the Economic Committee.
There is this principle which has been true since the old times that says necessity is the mother of invention. Sanctions haven't created the most ideal situation. We don't want to be subject to sanctions. We don't want to invite them to sanction us. We want to have relations with every country in the world. We firmly believe in this and don't have any other claims. But the point is, we have a set of aspirations and goals that are very important to us. They've put us through a lot of hardships over the past 4 years to increase the cost of achieving those ideals. But we endured them all. When they refused to sell us something, we produced the same goods, either with less sophisticated technology or at higher costs. The sanctions led us to use our potential. They forced us to go after what we had, but were ignoring.
Iran, with its memory of an 8-year war in isolation, has in fact been all the more resolved to work on its defenses and technological know-how, from ballistic missiles to a peaceful nuclear program for further energy and medical purposes. To Iran, a siege is a siege, be it military or intendedly crippling economic sanctions. And the enemy is not exactly negotiable to Iran. Latest case in point, the Vienna talks aimed at lifting sanctions off Iran. Sanction lifting would be to get Iran to go back on its nuclear program yet again and have the West help it get its foreign trade up and running in return. Except Iran is not hanging about and waiting for the West, but has already adopted a lean-to-east policy. Of course, regional developments have also not helped the US's goal of totally isolating and boxing Iran up within its own borders. Now, some other questions are whether sanctions will cause problems in answering the country's needs in the long term, and what would be the solution? Well, one solution could be one of the positive consequences of sanctions, that is domestic manufacture, possibly rendering this country independent of its boycotters.
We can procure resources and raw materials we need from a variety of different sources, either domestically or from foreign markets. And with proper planning and putting aside many mistakes and trials and errors that have been done over the past years. In such a scenario, our first response to the sanctioning countries is that you have locked yourself out of the Iranian market and deprived yourself of engaging in business with us. This is a cost imposed on you. We can obtain our resources from elsewhere. It might come at a higher cost, but we will do that. Why? Because it results in much higher national achievements.
Since the 2018 U.S. pullout from the JCPOA or nuclear deal, and even more so since 2020, Iran has gotten better at evading U.S. sanctions on its crude oil exports. We may have had to offer steep discounts to lure buyers who are comfortable skirting them, say traders. But we've managed, especially over the last couple of years, when new customers have emerged for Iranian crude, especially as Asian economies, including China, have bounced back. It's not a new approach the U.S. keeps on testing by trial and error. Since Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution, America and allies have taken tight economic measures against this country via the UN, after which they wait for concessions that never seem to materialize. Since 1979 and the U.S. embassy takeover in Tehran, the U.S. has employed its dual-track policy of leaving the door ajar for negotiation while making life difficult with economic hardship, in hope the government will change its policy, or if not, that the people will pressure their government into doing so. Except, sanctions statistically haven't worked efficiently, even on a global scale. In looking at the U.S.'s track record, the Vox recalls how to many U.S. sanctions are at best the foreign policy equivalent of saying bad dog. It continues, by looking at political science literature, there is no real connection between the sanction-imposed pain on ordinary citizens and a rise of anti-government protest movements. In fact, it is the threat of sanctions, in particular smart sanctions, that have a better track record. Smart sanctions are what target elites, but not the broader economy, and so don't hurt ordinary citizens. Regardless of protests, here's how the sanctioned state can handle sanctions. It's what Iran did once upon a time.
There are two aspects to sanctions. One is the negative aspect, which results in higher costs, creating shortages and dissatisfaction amongst the people, which has been noticeable. The other aspect, if managed properly, can turn the threats into opportunities. Take gasoline, for example. They sanctioned our gasoline imports. We were using 70 million liters of gasoline a day, a third of which was imported and the rest refined domestically. We realized that the enemies want to disrupt our daily lives by targeting gas. Therefore, we immediately put all our efforts into the refineries so they could output more gasoline, and soon our reserves were full again. This meant that we made assumptions and acted on them. In those areas where we had careful planning, we've been able to resist the pressure. The same is true about the technologies and innovations in the production sector. Imagine antibiotics. We realized that there was a shortage of medicine and that the enemies can pressure us with that. So we immediately took action. My point is, if we consider the outcome of the sanctions carefully, we can turn the negative aspect of the bans into positive ones for the production.
The same basically German study reads, one sanction threat makes significant anti-government protests in the following month an impressive 77% more likely to take place. Now, if one credible sanctions threat comes on the heels of another, the increase in protest probability goes up by 212%. If the sanctions are targeted at elites and not the population, they go up to a staggering 400%. But this effect goes kaput once sanctions are actually imposed. In fact, none of the measures of imposed economic sanctions achieve statistical significance in causing protests. Iran is a case in point. But hats off to Iran, as it has suffered history's longest and harshest sanctions ever. Mr. Sabzalipour is president of Iran World Trade Center with pretty strong views about how matters are run. He'll share with us what there's time and room for within our angles of the day.
Qatar, which was under a blockade by only two countries, namely Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and not the whole world, faced a shortage of goods at its shops. Take Russia, which we've been hearing about a lot in the news lately. For example, the exclusion from SWIFT is gradually affecting the Russian banks and halting their progress. And they've been under sanctions for only 10 days. But we've been facing sanctions for 42 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. We've been under the most severe form of sanctions for the past 16 to 17 years, from when the 9th administration was in place until now. But Iran is still standing strong.
Short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Hats back on, as it could have done so much better. Because really, sanctions just make up for 30% of our economic woes, according to our experts. 70% has to do with our own mismanagement and corruption, although sanctions have created grounds for corruption. Say, smuggling boycotted goods for big fat commissions that don't necessarily make returns to the country's financial cycle. Another problem is rentierism.
There are several reasons why we have had this much resilience. For one thing, Iran is a vast country with a very high diversity of climate and mineral resources. There are opportunities in every corner of this country, resources that even several European nations combined might not have. If we can make good use of this unique God-given capacity that exists in this country with the right and appropriate planning, along with the capacity of an educated and motivated young workforce that we have in the country, we can also increase the cost of sanctions for our enemies. we can send them the message that we are not a nation that can be sanctioned.
Plenty more to be said, but first a quick news review to give a chance to other media outlets to have their say. Do stay tuned. And here's how they put it in words. The Tehran Times reads, Iran to become fully self-sufficient in producing petchem catalysts by 2023. Managing Director of Iran's Petrochemical Research and Technology Company, PRTC, has said the country is going to become fully self-sufficient in producing the catalysts used in the petrochemical industry by the Iranian calendar year 1402, which starts in March 2023. As Shana reported, Majid Daftari has said that out of 40 types of catalyst groups in the petrochemical industry, the knowledge of the production of 20 has been indigenized, adding by the end of this year, March 20, 2022, the knowledge for producing 8 more groups will be indigenized and the remaining 12 groups are being researched or developed. According to plans by the Iranian calendar year 1402, Iran will not need to import the main catalysts required by the petrochemical industry, he stressed. Daftari noted that over the past few years, despite the sanctions, the PRTC has tried to meet the needs of the domestic companies regarding petrochemical catalysts in collaboration with other knowledge-based companies. In talking of surviving sanctions, how much has Iran's foreign trade risen? The Financial Tribune says Iran's foreign trade rises 38% to $90 billion in 11 months. Iran's foreign trade, excluding crude oil exports, stood at 149.4 million tons worth $90 billion during the current Iranian year's first 11 months, which is March 21, 2021 to February the 19th, registering a 12% and 38% growth in tonnage and value compared with the corresponding period of last year. According to Furud Askari, the deputy head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Customs Administration, exports stood at 112.65 million tons worth $43.52 billion, registering a 10% and 40% year-on-year growth in weight and value, respectively, Fars News Agency reported. Imports stood at 36.77 million tons worth $46.57 billion, registering a 19% and 36% year-on-year increase in volume and value, respectively. The customs official noted that the imports mainly included essential goods, raw materials, production machinery, pharmaceuticals, and medical equipment. Tasnim News has a little something to say about Iran's regional outlook. Iran-Armenia, eye expansion of trade ties. Leading a high-ranking delegation of trade officials and private entrepreneurs, Iranian Minister of Industry, Mining and Trade Reza Fatemi Amin paid a visit to Armenia as part of Tehran's efforts to strengthen trade ties with its neighbors. The visit comes as part of efforts to expand trade ties with Armenia in order to use its capacities to enter the Eurasian market, says Alireza Peymanpak, head of Iran's trade promotion organization, who is among the top officials accompanying the Iranian minister during his trip to Armenia. Such visits are aimed at facilitating trade by Iran's private sector in neighboring countries and tackling issues impeding business activities. Implementation of trade agreements, cooperation in free zones, commodity trade, transportation, customs are among the economic issues to be discussed in the meetings between Iranian and Armenian officials. That'll be it for this segment, but do stay tuned. Now, there have been preventions and solutions to mismanagement and corruption, such as unifying involved governmental ministries and bodies and creating a national expansion fund to support a resistance knowledge-based economy. But a fat government and slim private sector have meant consumption of the expansion fund for government expenses and extravagance rather than its use in industry. See, this fund was to be stashed with extra petrodollars to be ideally used in manufacture. But it is government-controlled, and the manufacturing core is not as fat as it should be.
Unfortunately, the resistance economy has turned into a political issue in the country. Different camps are at odds with each other over the measures they need to take in the resistance economy, blocking each other's steps just because they come from the opposing side. This is while all countries have been practicing resistance economies, although the names might be different. The U.S. has a resistance economy too. What does that mean? It means that we want our economies to be resistant and powerful. Who doesn't want a powerful and resistant economy? South Korea, Japan, Germany, the U.S., and others have had resistance economies. Each and every one had a different name for it. All of them have become strong economies and turned into superpowers today. We need to work more on the issue. We don't need the JCPOA for that. I'm convinced that even without the JCPOA and with the sanctions in place, we can develop the country.
In the Supreme National Security Council, an institution called the Special Measures Headquarters was established, consisting of several ministers and various officials, which gave approvals to specific demands. For example, there could have been people who could have imported wheat or any raw materials. They couldn't get in through conventional methods, including tenders or auctions, so they would have no other way but to procure them through illegal and unconventional ways. They would put their case to the committee, to which I was a secretary at the time. After secretly raising the issue, they'd be granted permission. Sometimes they'd even import the goods at higher costs too.
However, while bigger manufacturers such as car makers in this country who are dependent on imported raw materials have had to downsize, small and medium businesses have filled the void for everyday commodities people need. Talking of bigger manufacturers hitting hard times in this country, Iran's large automotive industry, for example, slashed output from under 1.5 million cars in 2017 to over 991,500 cars in 2021. That's according to the International Organization of Motor Vehicle Manufacturers. But looking at smaller companies,
یه مشکلی که ما داریم اینه که دولت هنوز بخش خصوصی رو اونجور که باید و شاید.
One of the problems we have is that the government has not yet accepted and does not recognize the private sector as it should, and perhaps does not use the private sector as it must. They need to realize the fact that governments don't build nations. It hasn't been the case anywhere in the world. It's the private sector that builds a country.
Thanks to U.S. sanctions, French cosmetics company L'Oréal in 2018 abandoned acquisition talks with Zarsima Namirasa. And that Iranian firm launched its own line of products that have since replaced L'Oréal in many a Tehran hair salon. The company said its domestic focus allowed it to retain about 450 workers, as reported in 2020, like the next few examples. Iranian home appliance manufacturer Park Shama Company made the most of the departure of LG Electronics and Samsung, the much larger South Korean competitors. Park Shama made Iran's first domestically produced dishwashing machine, the Josephine, named after the machine's inventor, Josephine Cochran. Park Shama's sales of dishwashers and washing machines surged 40% and 55% from 2018 to 2020, allowing the company to hire 600 workers. This, its marketing manager Mehrdad Nikzad said. Be it by manufacture or imports, some items just have to be provided, and Iran did this, our guest reminisces.
We made every effort to supply basic goods despite all the problems in the supply chain. We identified 24 goods that were essential for the people. Those included vegetable oil, rice, corn, medicine, and others. We planned for the 24 goods, taking into account all the factors influencing the supply, distribution, monitoring, and decision-making system so they can reach the 60 million Iranians easily and with the least amount of fluctuation in their prices to fully address the concerns of the citizens.
Naturally, no country can and should produce 100% of all the materials it needs on its own, because there's a discussion of comparative and absolute advantage. Every country has an advantage in producing products or providing services. Some powers with colonial histories use the matter to pressure sovereign nations. Since the day of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the Islamic Republic in Iran, our enemies and those who consider their interests lost in Iran introduce sanctions against our country.
In the same year, 2020, about 1,000 small and medium-sized companies created or reinstated 17,000 jobs, the deputy head of Iran's Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization told IRNA. They accounted for 92% of this country's manufacturing enterprises and 45% of its industrial jobs, according to the organization. Iran's unemployment rate over the decade leading to 2020 had decreased to 9.5% from under 12.5%, according to government statistics. Now, if sanctions have inadvertently helped the country's industry, perhaps they've also set it on a path of independence of its crude oil exports. To what extent and what businesses have found an opportunity in limitations and shortcomings? The governing system here is neither liberal nor socialist. It supports private enterprise while supporting the poor as well via institutions such as the Imam Khomeini Aid Foundation. The actual functioning of these foundations are a platform for good work, if not at the expense of national economy or other echelons of society other than their protectees. That is... That'll be it for today, but do look out for more as we'll be back with the Vienna talks and whatnot, same time, same days. For now, bye from the whole team.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a question that kind of is often raised in the minds of the followers of Imam Hussein and the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. That question is related to something that is well known regarding the events of the day of Ashura. Of course, we realize that right now we're not in the month of Muharram, and it's probably not very suitable to be mentioning this question here at this very time. Nevertheless, because this is an important question and it might be related to other problems as well, we'd like to kind of mention it here today and talk about it. And it's interesting to note that we're in the month of Sha'ban, just past the birthday of Imam Hussein and the birthday of his noble brother, Hazrat Abbas. And from this point of view, we feel that it's suitable to talk about a problem related to those two great personalities. We can pose this question in the following way, or sometimes this question is posed in this way. Some people say that the Euphrates is a very long river, and at the same time, the army of Imam Hussein was also, and Imam Hussein alayhi salam, was also well aware of the fact that water was going to be close to him. He wouldn't have access to water soon, and obviously he knew he was running out of water. Of course, we would like to add the reservation here that according to authentic historical accounts, there was water present until the eve of the day of Ashura. This is attested to by the fact that the son of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Ali Akbar, alayhi salam, said, "O father, my thirst has killed me, or has tortured me." Right. So, what exactly happened? What should we really believe with respect to this phenomenon that might have occurred on the day of Ashura? Before we get to answering this question, we, by way of introduction, we might say that unfortunately, the event of Ashura and the uprising of Imam Hussein is a very important event, especially for followers of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam. And there's a lot of, you know, beneficial discussions that we can conduct with respect to it. But unfortunately, a lot of people zero in on this problem and discuss it unnecessarily at length. And when this, you know, is not really doesn't hold that much weight and importance as it, you know, to the extent that it's given. In any case, maybe in today's session and maybe in some of the forthcoming sessions, we're going to try to look at this problem from a historical point of view and examine what a lot of the historical texts say in this regard. According to reliable historical texts, it's been mentioned that 3 days before the martyrdom of Imam Hussein on the 10th of Muharram, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad gave an order to Umar al-Sa'd to distance Imam Hussein and his army from Euphrates River and from the water of the Euphrates, and to not allow him to drink even one drop of water. And it's been recorded that the army of Yazid and Umar al-Sa'd and Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad understood this to be a form of revenge for Uthman being prevented from drinking water. So there is mention in historical sources of this order being given. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the absence of water on the day of Ashura from a historical point of view. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
In the streets of the Chadian capital city, an actor is bringing culture to impoverished neighborhoods by organizing readings of poetry and plays.
Culture should be accessible to all. If we want to have a wonderful world, a harmonious world, everyone should be focused on the same dimensions to be able to dream together. And without culture, we won't be able to initiate development. And to initiate this stage of development, we need to invite people to think together.
The actor does not have a fixed place to tell his stories. He performs in public spaces and says it is his way of giving everyone the opportunity to discover and explore creativity. Among the activities Bonaventure organizes, one can name drawing with children and conducting acting classes. He believes music and theater bring other disciplines together, creating an avenue for enriching human connections. Residents, especially the children of the impoverished neighborhood, say they always look forward to Bonaventure's arrival. A first-of-its-kind selfie museum in the Central American country of Guatemala is gaining lots of attention from excited enthusiasts. The selfie museum is located in Antigua, Guatemala, and is made up of 40 rooms or scenarios. Each room is a recreation of a colorful theme. Wallpaper, wings, greenery, neon signs, and other props are all present to spark the interest of visitors. One room includes a levitating bed, and another is equipped with a spaceship. Other rooms have familiar scenarios of presidential offices and comic book characters for visitors to take photographs in. Several artists participated in creating the art illustrations. A zoo in Peru's capital city, Lima, is celebrating a rare hatching of endangered baby crocodiles. The Huachipa Zoo showcased 3 females and 1 male to the public on the World Wildlife Day. The 4 crocodiles were born in incubators as part of the conservation efforts for the reptile. This species is an American crocodile, which is on the endangered list of animals in Peru. Zookeepers say the black market and threats on their habitat habitat have seen the crocodile population dwindle. The zoo regularly receives animals that were rescued from trafficking. Among those traits are tortoises, macaws, and monkeys.
The 2022 World Cup is reaching a fever pitch as hundreds of people line up at a shopping center in Qatar to take a picture with a trophy. The famous Golden World Cup trophy was unveiled during a ceremony at a mall in Doha, where excited football fans waited for their turn to see it. They were also given the option to take a selfie or have their photo taken professionally. While the competition is still nearly a year away, FIFA says more than a million tickets were requested within the first 24 hours after sales opened. The highest demand came from fans from Qatar, followed by Argentina, Mexico, and the United States, among others. Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mughal courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoch, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Gogh's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news and more from every corner of the world.
Persian language takes center stage in a conference in Tehran dubbed Promotion of Persian Language on Global Scale. The event seeks to preserve the ancient language through teaching it to non-Iranians. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Iran Imruz.
Persian language has been spoken for 3 millennia, but like every cultural heritage, it needs to be preserved. This is according to officials from Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who sat with Persian language activists to discuss ways to promote Persian through teaching it to non-Iranians.
Today is actually the Persian language day for me and for many of my colleagues. So if you allow me, I would like to continue in Farsi.
Thank you for this opportunity. The identity of a nation is a set of shared beliefs, shared culture and history, and all of these issues are reflected in the language that each nation speaks. So today, all of those who have a role in the promotion of Persian language gathered to exchange views on the preservation of Persian, and we at the Foreign Ministry will facilitate any effort made in this regard.
1,000 years ago,
Iran had a poet named Ferdowsi whose poems are still popular and understood by our generation. This is significant and shows that Persian is an old language that has stayed intact through the centuries.
Sa'di Foundation is the leading entity in the promotion of Persian language. Every year, the Institute, together with the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, holds a number of Persian refresher courses in and outside Iran for non-Persian speakers. Recently, the Institute has launched online courses and published self-study books for Persian language enthusiasts.
By launching the online Persian training platforms, we saw a sudden increase in the number of applicants from different countries. This is because many of those who are interested in learning Persian gained an instant access to Persian teaching contents. At the same time, we continue to launch in-person courses organized by Iran's cultural attaches and hosted by Iranian overseas schools.
Persian comes from the Indo-European family of languages. The earliest versions of Persian date back to roughly 2,500 years ago, during the Achaemenid dynasty. Today, it is spoken by more than 300 million people in the world, and different dialects, including Dari and Pashto, in countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. Besides its significant impact on science, medicine, and astronomy, Persian has its own prominent place in literature and poetry. Khayyam, Rumi, Sa'di, and Hafez are only a few examples of world-renowned Persian poets.
Language is the identity of a nation, and through the centuries of its spoken and written history, Persian has grown to become the narrator of Iran's rich past and its ancient civilization. Now, as learning a language is learning a culture, experts here say promoting Persian on a global scale is translated into introducing Iran and its culture to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbey Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It's fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf.
IRIB English Radio.